Okay, comrades, this is the third discussion session of the Socialism Weekend, which I hope you've all enjoyed so far. This session is on how a democratically planned economy could work with Hannah Sal, Deputy General Secretary of the Socialist Party, speaking. Hannah will speak for 40 minutes before it opens up to discussion.
Okay, thank you very much, Bob. First of all, just out of interest, how many of you have been to the other sessions in this course? What's the course actually called? I can't remember. But the ones with Lynn Walsh speaking, how many of you have been to them? Okay, so not many, actually. Most of you have not followed the course. But I'm sure whichever sessions you've been to, then you've heard lots and lots about why capitalism doesn't work. And even if you've arrived and this is your first session of the whole weekend and you've not been to the rest of it, no doubt what motivated you to come here is the fact you already know capitalism doesn't work as a result of your own experience. So there's probably unanimity on at least the main strands of what's wrong with the world that we live in at the moment. But I would also say that amongst some of you in this room, and certainly amongst the people that you try to convince to join the Socialist Party, if you're already members yourselves, there will be many people who agree about what's wrong with capitalism, but are unconvinced that a different, better world is possible, that a socialist world is possible. Now, we would argue, actually, that's inevitable. We live in a society where a tiny minority control the means of production, control industry, control the big companies that dominate the globe, and also dominate the media, which after all is also owned by big multinationals, dominate the political system, the state, the whole of society is dominated by the ideas of that ruling elite. And it's not in their interest to give us the idea that any kind of change is possible. And so they always give the impression that it was ever thus, that everything has always been like it is at the moment. But of course, in reality, if any of you went to the session on history in the last block, for the 200,000 years or so of human history, and capitalism as a system has only existed for less than 400 of those years. So it's existed for a very short part of human history in reality. And even if you look back a century ago, then workers, working class people who had to sell their labour power in order to survive, were a small minority of the population of the planet. Whereas today, at least in the economically advanced countries like Britain, working class people are the big majority. Even if they don't all know they're working class, people who have to sell their labour power are the big majority of society. Capitalism has vastly changed the world. Of course, it's also destroying it. The unplanned nature of capitalism means that the environment is being destroyed. But if you look at what's happened under capitalism, I mean, I'm not going to list it all, you all know, but the development of electricity, of telecommunications, of computers, of space travel, the world has been transformed. And at the same time, human attitudes have changed enormously, because we would say in the end, the way people think is as a result of the kind of economic society that they live in. So just to give one example, and you could give many, and this actually is a positive example about capitalism. We live in a sexist society. Women are paid less than men. Women in general suffer oppression. However, the conditions that women live in today in Britain or in other economically advanced countries are completely different to what existed before capitalism or even 100 years ago, where women before capitalism were simply possessions of men, owned by their fathers and then by their husbands, who had no rights in general whatsoever. We now live in a society where that idea, even though there's still remnants of it there, is abhorrent to the vast majority of people. Ideas have changed. In feudal society, the idea of a blood feud, that it was okay to go and kill the relative of someone who'd harmed you because they were the relative of the person that had harmed you, was normal. That is now not an idea that is accepted in capitalist society. So capitalism has changed the world, and it's changed the way that people think. But because the capitalist elite want to keep capitalism, they don't encourage the idea that that's taken place. They don't want people to think about it. Because if you think about that, then you start thinking about, well, why not more change? Why can't we change things further? Why can't we do more than what has already been done? And this is true, by the way, not just of economic systems as a whole, but also of the particular ideology that dominates within an economic system, particular eras. So we've all lived through a neoliberal era. And we've all been told, as complete fact, that privatisation is a really good thing, public ownership is completely outmoded, that there's a home-owning democracy where everybody's going to be able to buy their own home, where boom and bust has been abolished. And people like us, who've said, no, that's not true, we don't agree with it, have been a small and relatively isolated minority. We then saw an economic crisis last year, which of course is still going on, which brought capitalism and society as a whole up against the reality of what was true, what we've been arguing, and those ideas were put out of the window and they had to adapt. And there were a few months where capitalist ideology was in complete disarray as a result of that. But of course, they then find a new eternal truth, which they pump out to everybody. And so now we're all being told it's because the public sector's too big and we've got to cut the public sector and that's how we're going to solve the economic crisis, which is laughable. But it's put out by all of the media as an accepted fact. I'll give a tiny little example. I went on the Jeremy Vine show, which I sometimes go on Radio 2, and there was an argument on this issue. And I said, what do you mean it's the fault of the public sector? It's the fault of the banks, etc., etc. And Jeremy Vine said, rubbish. And then you could see it flick across his face, a memory of a year ago, and he went, oh, yeah. And it's like, I mean, he's obviously not a particularly intelligent individual, but it's like, it's so overwhelming, that propaganda. People forget what came before and what the reality was before. Now, the degree to which that ideology from the ruling class works is not constant, of course. There are times when it just doesn't wash. So some of this stuff about the public sector is washing at the moment. But when it comes to people's own schools and hospitals being closed, it's not going to wash. People are going to say, no, we don't accept them being shut. Look at the Royal Mail, the postal workers' strike. Despite all the propaganda, the big majority of the population have supported the postal workers. So it's not washed. People's own experience means that they haven't accepted it. And if you like a revolutionary change in society, when working class people take power, one of the signs of that is when the propaganda of the capitalists just ceases to wash at all, people won't accept it anymore and begin to fight for a different kind of society. However, it has to be said that in the current economic crisis, one advantage that capitalism has had, probably the only advantage that the representatives of capitalism have had, is a lack of mass parties putting the case for socialism, which means they've been able to get away with a lot more than they would otherwise have been. And if there'd been mass parties at the start of this crisis arguing for socialism, then they would have grown exponentially, gaining hundreds of thousands of members. That's not happened in that way. But nonetheless, in a slower way, there are increased numbers of people who are questioning capitalism and are moving in the direction of socialist ideas. Because the objective case for socialism is absolutely clear. And that's not always been true. It's not a kind of thing that we would say absolutely regardless. There have always been people who've argued for socialism. So if you go right back to the dawn of capitalism, to the English Revolution, the left wing of that, the levellers, the diggers, they were a revolutionary movement and they argued for socialist ideas, communistic ideas, in the best sense of the term. The idea that the world is a pyramid with a few at the top and the mass at the bottom, and what should be done is to turn it upside down, and that that would mean equality. But while they argued for those ideas, there wasn't the material basis to create a socialist society back then. It was utopian, actually. It's a great idea, but it couldn't be brought into being. Capitalism, nightmare as it is, has created the material means to begin to build a socialist planned economy. The world economy today is 17 times the size it was even a century ago, 100 years ago. And yet, there are still more than a billion people who don't have access to clean drinking water, 2.5 billion people without modern sanitation, 1.5 billion people who live on less than a dollar a day, and there will be 200 million more of those, it's estimated by the UN, as a result of the current economic crisis. The Iraq war has cost so far $700 billion. It would take less than a tenth of that to give humanity, the whole of humanity, clean drinking water. And yet that idea is utopian under capitalism. It will not happen. The $1 trillion a year that I've spent on average since the end of the Cold War on the arms race, on armaments, if you divided that up for every family on the planet, from the poorest to the richest, it would mean an extra $1,000 a year. But on the basis of capitalism, that will never happen. It will not happen because capitalism, as we all know, is a system driven by the drive to make profits, a blind and crisis-ridden system driven purely by a profit motive. However, just as, if you go back before capitalism, in the previous economic system, under feudalism, you could see the seeds of capitalism before it developed. The merchants, the traders, the small business people, if you like, who later became a capitalist class. In the same way, the nightmare of capitalism today shows the potential, at the same time, for the development of a socialist society. We have all this propaganda about the free market. And the talk is now that because of what's happened with the collapse of the banks, nationalisation and so on, it's a move away from the free market. But it wasn't the free market. It's not the free market now. And it wasn't the free market that existed before the economic crisis. It's not free at all. It's dominated, as Marx predicted would happen 150 years ago, by an ever-shrinking number of multinational companies. It's about 100 multinational companies worldwide that control 70% of world trade. It's about 500 companies worldwide that dominate the economy as a whole, that produce the vast majority of the world's goods. And the effect of the current recession will not be to reverse that process. It will be the opposite. Some of those big multinationals will go to the wall and they'll be gobbled up by other multinationals and you'll be left with even fewer big companies at the end of it. One of the things that Marx and Engels predicted was that as capitalism develops into a monopoly capitalism, the capitalists themselves will become increasingly redundant. There'd be no longer people who worked out what goods should be produced and built the factories and actually did concrete things, even though it was the workers who still really produced the goods, but they would become nothing more than gamblers on the world stock market. So, in Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, written a very long time ago, before they had hedge funds and all the things that we've seen in the recent crisis, then Engels says, all the social functions of the capitalist are now performed by salaried employees, they're the chief executives and so on. The capitalist has no further social function than the pocketing of dividends, the tearing off of coupons, and gambling on the stock exchange, where the different capitalists despoil one another of their capital. Well, that describes modern capitalists. The capitalists themselves do nothing of any use whatsoever. But you have these giant multinationals, and for all the capitalists, the little planning, say that planning could never work, all of those multinational companies plan to an enormous extent. They have very intricate plans. So, for example, every big car manufacturer in the world fixed the prices of their components in order basically to cook the books. So they decide what different components cost in different parts of the world. They have a huge, Ford has a giant computer program that plans it all and organises it. And as a result of that, there was a survey done of 200 big US companies that worked out they pay less than half the tax they ought to pay by this giant cooking of the books around the world. Give the idea of how absurd it gets. Ford have shipped tweezers, you know, tweezers for doing your eyebrows, and toilet seats in and out of Hong Kong and Indonesia because it helps their tax returns to do it. They pay less tax if this stuff. So it's complete madness, but it's planning purely in order to increase their profits and to avoid paying taxes. So it's planning for profits. What we want to do is to plan in order to build a new society. Now, that will never happen under capitalism because of the fundamental contradictions of a capitalist economy. Very briefly, because a lot of you will have been in sessions that will have discussed this, but if you look at the contradictions of capitalism, the contradiction, especially today, of the fact there is a world market, and yet still, these multinationals are mainly based on nation states and cannot completely overcome the limits of a nation state. And you can see that in the crisis. The propaganda was these are all global companies. They've got no home market. But that's not how it's worked. Once the crisis has hit, and they've all fought to defend their particular capitalism against the others around the world. There's also the contradiction between the collective nature of production, where it's a mass of people working together to make things, and the private ownership of that of those multinationals. And of course what we argue is that those multinationals should be taken in to public ownership, democratic public ownership. It's a sign of the bankruptcy of capitalism that they've been forced to do them, not democratic, but forced to take different banks into public ownership in order to defend their system. But where they've done it, of course, it's done purely to defend profits, and they're going to sell them off. In Britain, us, the taxpayer, are going to keep the debt, and then they're going to sell the profitable bit back off to the private sector. But we would argue those big companies should be bought into public ownership in order to act in the interest of ordinary working class people. Now, is it possible? Would it be possible for a socialist government to come to power and to say, right, in Britain, we're going to nationalise the top 150 monopolies? Let's be clear, we're not naive. With a socialist government to do that on its own, without the mass support of the population, the bankers, the capitalists would stop it. They prevent it. They say, no way, you're not allowed to do that. But if you have a movement of working class people, the people who make the goods, the millions, who say, we support this government, we're fighting for this, we're occupying our factories, we're demonstrating, we're taking to the streets, capitalists won't be able to do anything about it. They'd be prepared, don't doubt it, to use the army or the police against such a socialist government because it would threaten their interests. But the majority of the army and the police, even though the tops are firmly in the camp of the capitalists, are ordinary people. And if we explain to them what we're fighting for is a decent minimum wage for everybody, a decent health service, a decent free education system, you will be able to win away the majority to what that government was doing. And that, of course, is what happened in the Russian Revolution. The revolution itself was very peaceful, actually, because they were able to win over or to neutralise the big majority of the state forces. And what could such a government do? Let me just give a very few examples. First of all, on the question of wages, we heard throughout this weekend how big business are saying that the public sector wage bill has got to be cut. And yet, if you look back before the recession, when the public sector trade unions were still fighting for wage increases, they've really abandoned that at the moment, but they were fighting for more significant wage increases, to meet every single public sector trade union's demand would have cost £5 billion. That compares to the £1.2 trillion that had been used to underwrite the banking system. It's clear, isn't it? It would be affordable to immediately meet the demands of public sector workers. We would want, a socialist government would want, to immediately introduce a real living minimum wage. We have the demand on the back of the socialists of £8 as a step towards £10 an hour. But in fact, you would almost certainly be able to introduce a far higher living wage for people than that immediately if a socialist government was to come to power and take the major industry into public ownership, just by the stopping of the creaming off of the profits that are taken by the capitalists at the moment. Or the question of the working week. We've had an irony, haven't we, in Britain in the last year, that a third of people have had their working week cut, something they've been campaigning for a long period of time, except it's been cut without pay, because the capitalists are trying to protect their profits by sending workers home, putting them on short-time working, and so on. But we would argue you could immediately introduce, again, we demand a 35-hour week, but actually you could immediately introduce a 30-hour week or less without any loss of pay for the workers the workers in Britain. Why is that? Well, we still have the longest working week in Europe, even during the recession, even with all the people whose hours have been cut. Because it's cheaper for the capitalists to have a few people working for 48 or more hours a week, and at the same time to have other people who are on the dole who are unable to get work. So you share out the work. That's the first thing that you would do immediately. But it's also a question of how new technology is used by capitalism. And Royal Mail is a perfect example of this. I know it's still at least partly publicly owned, but they're trying to run it like a private business. They want to privatise it. And what does that mean? It means the new technology, the walk-in machines and all the rest of it, which potentially could be labour-saving devices, so postal workers had an easier life, instead are used to sack loads of postal workers and to pile even more work onto them so that they're carrying heavier bags than normal. They can't finish their shift in time and so on. And that's always the case under capitalism. New technology is used to increase profits and make a few people work harder. But why can't it be used instead to cut the working week in order to enable people to have a decent life? So we would argue that immediately you would cut the working week, you would use new technology to do that, and employ more people. But at the same time, I've lost my place slightly there. Anyway, on the working week, it's a sign of the bankruptcy of modern capitalism. But if you go back to 1920, workers in most European countries won the 8-hour day in about 1920, at least in heavy industry. It's gone from a 12-hour day down to an 8-hour day, and it's gone no further since. The battle for a 35-hour week was never won, an 8-hour day is a 40-hour week. And now, of course, it's going back in the other direction. But very quickly, a workers' government, a socialist government, will be able to cut the working week and at the same time, of course, move towards full employment very quickly. How do you do that? As I've already said, the question of sharing out the work. But also the question of doing more of what is needed. Of more hospitals, smaller classes, free nurseries for every parent who wants to put their children into nurseries, more doctors and local GP surgery, more houses. As Bob Crowe said last night, take the million billions on the dole and build houses. These very basic things would quickly create employment. Look at Cuba, by the way, as an example of this. Cuba is based on a planned economy, although it's not a workers' democracy. I'll go on to say it's not fully democratic. However, even though it's distorted, their health service is better than the US's, it's better than Britain's, it's better than anywhere else in the world, despite the poverty of that country, because it's run in the interest of the population. And the number of doctors per head of population is more than double what exists in Britain. It's four times what exists in the US. That gives you an idea of what you could begin to do if you were acting in the interest of humanity to put people to work, but also to use to provide the things that people need. Now, there are many other things that could be done in the very short term. The question of the banking system. Bob Crowe was right. What do we need all these banks for? Why can't we have one nationalised bank, but a bank that provides people with what they need? And by the way, that would include help for small business. The idea that a socialist government would mean the end for small business is not true. What is true is there are many millions of people in Britain at the moment who are only self-employed because they can't get a decent other job and will probably choose not to keep on doing it if they could get another decent job doing something else. But where people are running small businesses that are socially useful, and they're currently being crushed by the big monopolies, forced out of business by Tesco, Asda, and all the rest of them, they will be better off. And a nationalised bank will be prepared to give them cheap loans and so on. Even the question of a minimum wage. People raise with us, you introduce a £10 an hour minimum wage, how would small businesses pay for it? Well, if they're prepared to open their books, and they show that they genuinely cannot afford to do it, and they're doing something that is useful to society, you'd be prepared to say, OK, you can have a subsidy in order to be able to pay the minimum wage. So it would mean you'd have a banking system which would help ordinary working class people, but would also be prepared to help small business. One other point I'd make here on what you could do very quickly, and there's many, many other examples that could be given, but it's the question of the media, because there's often the kind of misunderstanding that you would nationalise the media And that would mean it would be completely monolithic. It would just put the position of the majority. We would nationalise the big media. Why should it be run by Murdoch and the rest of them, who, by the way, never pay a penny in taxes? But you wouldn't make it monolithic. You'd work out a system so that everybody got to put their point of view in the media. You could do something on the basis of the number of votes that different parties got, that they got a certain percentage of the media to put their ideas on the basis of their public support. So you wouldn't use it to be monolithic. You use it to open the media up to all the different views, to allow discussion and debate. And of course, the other issue that must be mentioned is the question of the environment. Again, it was mentioned last night. But it's a nightmare. That it's just outrageous that Vestas, this company that was making wind turbines at a time when this government was talking about introducing green jobs, was allowed to go to the wall. The workers were demanding its nationalisation, but the only reason it went to the wall, the government were prepared to give extra subsidies to Vestas, but Vestas was making huge profits. So extra subsidies didn't bother them. They were still going to go off to the US because they could make bigger profits there. The only way to save it was to nationalise it, and ideologically the government was not prepared to do that. But of course, the socialist government would take all of those companies into public ownership and would put major investment into developing environmentally friendly technologies in order to take the economy forward. And that really links to my next point, because even in Britain, to meet everybody's needs, it wouldn't just be a question of taking over the existing big companies and sharing out the wealth. It would require the development of the productive forces, the development of industry, the development of technique, in order to really be able to meet humanity's needs. That's in Britain. You've got a workers' government come to power in India. It's absolutely clear, isn't it, there would have to be an enormous development of industry, of productive technique, in order to meet the needs of humanity. We're not in favour of the idea of sharing out the misery. We want to bring everybody up to a higher level. Now, in many people's minds, that does raise the spectre of Stalinism. I'm going to say something on Stalinism later. But there's no doubt the Stalinist economy had a devastating effect on the environment. Well, you know, so did capitalism. But they also were responsible for a large destruction of the environment. What's the answer to that? The answer is to invest into technology that can allow you to increase production, but do it on an environmentally friendly basis. Wave power, wind power, solar power, geothermal power, and to move in that direction. And seriously, I mean, the capitalists now are panicking a bit about the crisis in the environment, so they're starting to try and do something. But it's so pathetic. I mean, they produce electric cars, but they're enormously expensive, and the only way to power them is to plug them into the national grid. And the national grid's electricity is overwhelmingly being made in non-environmentally friendly ways, so it doesn't take you any further forward at all. We would take a far more serious approach. Now, does that mean there will be no tension? Of course it doesn't. You can clearly see arguments developing about, do we hold back to provide every home in India with their own, whatever it is that they want, I don't know, their own TV or whatever, because we need to develop this technology to do it on a clean basis. What comes first? And there would be arguments and debates about that. A socialist society is not a monolithic society. There will be far more discussion and debate than there is at the moment, but the profit motive will be taken out of it. It will be a debate about how best you meet the needs of humanity at the same time as developing the environment. And that links to the critical issue that a planned economy could only work on the basis of democracy. And we don't just mean by that the kind of democracy we have in Britain today, where you get to vote every 4 or 5 years for some politician who then goes and does exactly whatever they like, and those politicians have limited power because it's the boardrooms that really decide what's happening, and of course our politicians all follow happily along behind those boardrooms. What we will be talking about is a far more fundamental kind of democracy. You will be talking about, in every workplace, in every community, having committees of elected representatives from the trade unions, the workforce, representatives from the national government as well, which will be discussing and debating what their factory, their community should be doing, but also feeding that up to the regional and national bodies. And you'd have real instant recall. So if the person you elect from your workplace, goes and votes for something at the regional body which you think is wrong, the next meeting you get rid of them. You don't wait. You say, that's it, you're off. We don't agree with what you did. Or you say to them, we like you otherwise, you can stay, but you're not allowed to do that again. It will be the choice of the meeting to decide. So a real system of working class people who were acting in the interests of those that they represented. Lenin put it when he was describing the workers' democracy that they began to try and build, even though it degenerated later in the Soviet Union, as the idea that every cook can be prime minister. And what he meant is that in every workplace committee, all workers would get to take part and would get elected to different bodies. So it would be a certain rotation of everybody taking part in the planning of society. Of course, critical to that is no material privileges. You don't get any extra money for taking part in these bodies. Now, people will say, would that work? Is it possible? Would people be prepared to take part in the running of society? But we would say, absolutely yes. Even now, today in Britain, look at the and actually participation is very low ebb at the moment in society, but look at the hundreds of thousands of people who take part in their tenants' associations, who take part in local trade union meetings, and they do it even though those meetings have got very little power. Often they're there, not able to change anything at all. We'd be talking about meetings that actually had the power to decide the running of society. And it is at a low ebb, participation at the moment. When class struggle takes place, it rises immediately. Look at the oil refinery workers earlier this year. They didn't just come out on unofficial indefinite strike action. They got up in the middle of the night. Our Socialist Party members will go to picket lines in the south of England, in the Midlands, and they would meet flying pickets from Lindsay who had driven through the night from North Lincolnshire, it's the middle of nowhere, to arrive at 5 a.m. to picket out those workplaces, and then the workers would come out with them and not cross the picket lines. Once there's a struggle taking place, once there's something to fight for, people show real dedication and willingness to participate. We saw that probably on the broadest scale in Britain in recent memory, although it's not that recent for most of you, in the anti-poll tax movement, which brought down Thatcher, which we were the kind of leading organisation within that movement. 18 million people didn't pay the tax. In every town, on every housing estate, there were anti-poll tax unions where people went and organised it and went and stopped the bailiffs taking away people's goods. It was an organisation of a mass campaign with mass participation. And we have to remember, we're only going to begin to be able to build this planned economy, this socialist society, on the basis of convincing the mass of people to take part in the struggle for it. So you're already starting at a much higher level. The reality is the embryo of those workplace committees, which would then go on to plan a new economy, would already have come out of the struggle to control those workplaces, to lead a fight to change society in the period before that had taken place. The idea, what gets called Soviets, which is a Russian word, and we obviously wouldn't use it in Britain or anywhere else, but the idea of Soviets, which did lead the Russian Revolution, which were mass bodies, not monoliths, mass bodies of ordinary working class people who fought to change society, they didn't come from Lenin or from the Bolshevik Party, although they took them up. They came spontaneously from the 1905 revolution before 1917. It was obvious to the workers themselves that that's what was necessary. And that's our experience in all revolutionary movements. Those kind of bodies begin to develop organically. Now, having said that, there is no doubt that the biggest propaganda the capitalists have in their favour against socialism is the idea, well, he tried it in the Soviet Union and it didn't work there. And therefore, it's clear that a planned economy doesn't work. Now, there's another session on what went wrong in the Soviet Union, and you've chosen to come to this one, so I'm not going to spend long on the question of what went wrong in the Soviet Union, but I would say it was the first time in history that the working class and poor had succeeded in overthrowing capitalism. And in that sense, it was the greatest event in human history. But it was a very poor country. It was left isolated despite a revolutionary wave in support of what existed in Russia. It was left isolated and alone because those revolutionary movements were not successful in other countries. And when we say it was left isolated, it got attacked by 21 capitalist armies desperate to crush it. It wasn't just like left on its own on a corner and ignored. They were desperate to try and crush the Soviet Union. By the way, The reason those armies went home was not the military might of the Red Army, great job as they did building it in a very short length of time. It was because those soldiers were being infected by the socialist plague and were saying, we agree with what they're doing. So a mass leaflet's been dropped on them saying, why are you fighting us? Go back and build socialism in your own country. And big business was so frightened, they were forced to withdraw the troops as a result of what they thought would happen. But it was left isolated and it did degenerate into horrific dictatorship, which bears no resemblance to what we are fighting for. It's not what we're fighting for at all. Let's be clear, despite everything that was wrong with it, nonetheless, I need to go backwards, how did I manage that? Hang on. Nonetheless, the very distorted form of a planned economy that they had in the Soviet Union did lead to an increase in living standards. It did develop the productive forces. Up until the 1970s, the Soviet Union grew far faster economically than any capitalist country. It did show in a distorted way the possibility of a planned economy. It went from a country much poorer than India is now, comparable to India 20 years ago, into being this superpower in which, while it was terrible, people did have a job, a home, could go to university, there were basic necessities that were provided for people. And when it collapsed, there was a 50% collapse in the productive forces in the Soviet Union. The average age, life expectancy of men fell by 10 years in 2 years. Imagine what that means in people's living conditions for that to take place. So that, if you like, shows in a distorted way how a planned economy could work. But of course, we're not fighting for the Soviet Union. What lessons do we learn? What differences would we point out? The first thing to say is that science and technique has developed enormously from the time, particularly in Russia, that the Russian Revolution took place. It's often said that in a socialist society, you'd have no decent consumer goods. You'd have heavy machinery would be all right, but all the stuff that people are using in their houses would be useless. And that was true in the Soviet Union. Consumer goods were generally shoddy, badly made. If there'd been democracy, even with that level of technique that existed in the Soviet Union, that would not have been the case. People would not have accepted it. They'd have said, we want decent stuff in our houses. We don't want to accept this kind of rubbish. But because there wasn't, then that was how it developed. So we'd have workers' democracy, but we'd also use all of the science and technique that exists today. And so, in fact, you'd be able to have a far wider range of those consumer goods which you want a lot of stuff of. Society would have to decide. So to give an example, I think it's very unlikely that a socialist society would say, a workers' state would say, we need 20 different kinds of washing powder, because what for? I mean, it's all the same, isn't it? You'd want one that washed your clothes and was environmentally friendly. However, clothes, I personally think we'd have a lot more different kind of clothes. And in fact, because of mass production, the fact that things are shoddily made, they're not actually made to fit real people, we'd organise it much better, so you could have a much wider variety. Look at the technology that exists now in order which is used to plan the world stock market, you know, all those incredibly complicated computers that they use to plan hedge funds and the rest of it. Why on earth couldn't all that technology be used to find out what people wanted and to make what people want, simply? To give a very, very simple example, probably you've all got a Tesco or an Asda or one of the supermarket loyalty cards. Every time you go in a shop, they record what you're buying. That's why they bother with them. So they can work out what best to sell to you. Now, they're doing that to make a profit. But why on earth couldn't that just be used in order to measure what people wanted, in order, therefore, to begin to develop the kind of consumer goods that people required? So we would do things differently on a much higher level. At the time of the Russian Revolution, the majority of the population were illiterate. They were trying to build a society at a very low level. We have all this technology and technique today which we would put to use. But the other big lesson that's got to be learned is that socialism must be international. The Soviet Union was left isolated. You cannot build, actually more so today than then, because globalisation means today the world economy is even more interlinked. You cannot build an island of socialism in one country. A socialist government could come to power in Britain and do everything that I've already described immediately. It could immediately make people's lives better. but there would be a limit. You'd have to spread to other countries in order to really be able to develop a full-going socialist democracy, and that's why we're part of an international. That's why we're in the Committee for Workers International. One of the great tragedies of the Russian Revolution is that they were part of an international, but it was the international, the majority of whom went and backed the First World War and sold out the working class just 3 years before the revolution. So they were left without an international party to fight for socialism worldwide. So we make sure that we do things differently today. And on the question of internationalism, let's be clear again. I think some of you would probably ask, well, you get this socialist government, you start doing all this good stuff, whether it's Britain, India, Sri Lanka, wherever, unless it's the US, wouldn't US imperialism come and try and crush you? And no doubt, capitalism would want to defend its interests. And the big world powers would want to try and crush any genuine socialist government. But they would not be able to do so. They have all the same problems that was had at the time of the Russian Revolution. Even today, Cuba is on the doorstep of the USA, and although they might manage to defeat it with cheap consumer goods, they can't invade it and militarily crush it, because it would lead to an uprising across Latin America in defence of the Cuban regime. The same with Venezuela. They tried behind the scenes to get Chavez overthrown. The masses in Venezuela rose up and said, no, we're putting him back. Whether they do that now after some of the things he's done since is a bit different. But they did that back in 2002, and the world powers had no choice but to accept it, including here in Britain, by the way. The night that Chavez was overthrown, the foreign minister was on the TV saying, we've got rid of that demagogue. That piece of TV footage has never been shown again, because, of course, he was democratically elected, and once the masses put him back in power, then they were unable to carry out what they wanted to do, which was to support the crushing of that government. So internationalism and spreading a revolutionary international is crucial, but would be possible. Look at the millions of people, the biggest simultaneous world movement in history that took place at the start of the Iraq War. That was to stop the invasion of a dictatorship, because people were against the war. You had a socialist democracy, you would have an enormous movement, bigger than we had at the time of the Russian Revolution, worldwide, for people to support it and to join it and to begin to build the same kind of society. Now, I'm nearly out of time, but I want to make a very few last points, because everything I've dealt with so far is the very early stages of the building of a new society. What Marx and Engels, what it will be proper to call a workers' state, a beginning. What that means is, first of all, you would still have a state. We live in a capitalist society where the state forces, the army, the police, the judiciary, act in the interests of a small minority of the capitalists. This will be a society where the state, and it wouldn't be the same state, you can't just take theirs over and run it, but the state would be the majority, the mass, acting in the interests of the mass. But it would still be a state machine. It would undoubtedly still be capitalists who are trying to reset capitalism up, and might try and, you know, do that in a military way, and then you would have to be prepared to act against them. There would also still be crime. The idea that you would instantly get rid of all of the ills of the old society would not be true. And as Brian Caton indicated last night, you deal with it in a different way, but you'd still have to be prepared to do that. In other ways as well, it would only be a beginning. So, for example, workers would get a really good wage, but you would still be going out to work and getting a wage. And by the way, still creating a surplus, but you didn't get all of it in your own pocket. But instead of that surplus going to the profits of the bosses, that surplus will be going to society as a whole to invest in developing new technology, in developing more hospitals, schools, as society democratically decided it should be done. That's what a workers' state would be. But that is only the beginning. Marx and Engels talked about a higher stage of socialism, what was called communism. We don't use that term because of the association with the communist regime, where the state would begin to wither away, where you would no longer need, even when it's run by the majority, that kind of repressive apparatus. You would have a state that existed only for administrative needs, to actually, you know, measure what was happening. They call that a society of superabundance, because it comes down to the economy in the end. What they meant by that is, if you begin to have a society where there's enough for everybody to have what they need and desire, then you don't any longer need to pay people wages and they go and buy things in a shop. They can just go and get whatever they want. That might sound utopian, but even under capitalism, there are things that previously and increasingly you fight over, but when they're freely available, you don't. So when I used to do all these kind of read-offs 10 years ago, he'd always give the example of water. Because no one in Britain fights over water. Of course, now with water meters, this is increasingly not true anymore, the generation of capitalism, but no one fights over water. You've got enough of it. The idea you fill your bath up with water in case there's not any there when you get home. Well, of course you wouldn't, because you know there will be some there when you get home. You go to many countries of the world where there's a real shortage of water, and people do. There are wars fought over water. Well, why can't it be the same with other goods today? Practically, how it would work would probably be gradually. So that you would say that public transport is available free. Basic foodstuffs that everybody needs is available free. And you would increasingly be able to use your wages for life luxuries, the things that you fancy doing, the holidays, the, I don't know, whatever you decide that life luxuries would be. But gradually, you would develop a society of superabundance where people's needs were met, and then you begin to operate on a different basis. I think the other side of it is just how the nature of work would change. Karl Marx famously said about capitalism, he said, the worker who for 12 hours weaves, spins, drills, turns, builds, shovels, breaks stones, carries loads, etc., does he do this 12 hours weaving, spinning, drilling, etc., etc., to be a manifestation of his life as life? On the contrary, life begins for him where his activity ceases, at the table, in the public house, in bed. The 12 hours labour has no meaning for him, but as earnings which bring him to the table, to the public house, into bed. If the silkworm were to spin in order to continue its existence as a caterpillar, it would be a complete wage worker. Well, that describes capitalism. But as he moved towards this kind of society, where you would use every labour-saving technique possible to make dirty work unnecessary, you would begin to be able to have a society where people worked fewer hours, but the hours that they did work were doing things they wanted to do in order to contribute to the development of humanity. So people would no longer be alienated from their labour in the same way. And, of course, we would all have time to develop ourselves as human beings. Human beings are potentially enormously talented, but capitalism stultifies us. You work hard in the day, and you go home, and if you're me, you watch Strictly Come Dancing on the TV. But you don't go dancing yourself and then ballroom dance. You just sit there like a cabbage watching other people doing it. Now, this is probably only me, and it's going to make you laugh. Not that bit. I know there are other people who do that bit. But I really like those programmes with that posh choir master. The choir, Gareth, yeah. I don't know if anyone else has watched them, but the reason I like them, I can't sing a note, by the way. The reason I like them is because he's this posh choir master, and he goes into working class schools and working class housing estates, and he takes these people who all think they can't sing a note, and he convinces them that they can sing beautiful music, classical and otherwise, and hundreds of them come together and they sing and they're moved by what they culturally can achieve, which they never thought they would be able to do. Now, maybe it's just because I dream of one day being able to sing a note, and I'm not sure even socialism could provide that, actually, but that, you know, we're unutilised as human beings. The other side of socialism is that you would be free to develop your talent and your technique. We'd introduce free education immediately, and it wouldn't just be for those few years between school and university. You would have the opportunity throughout your life to go back and study things, not because you needed them for your job, because you were interested in them, because you wanted to be able to do them. And on that basis, the whole of human society will be lifted to a far higher level than what we have today. And so we also have to bear that in mind. What I've raised is a brief outline. The reality will be beyond our imagining, because it will be future generations who are cleverer than us, as a result of being born into a different kind of society, who would really begin to build a socialist future for humankind. Thank you.